Good afternoon, and welcome to the Bill Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill, who is on a much-deserved vacation, hopefully having a little bit of fun with his bride. He's on an anniversary vacation. He would not disclose which anniversary. He's keeping that information closely held, but nonetheless, congrats to them both for many, many years, and especially kudos to her for putting up with Bill Buckmaster for so very long. We're going to dig into one of the really, I think, burning issues of the week here, the end of Title 42 and what that the impact of that will be on local communities here in southern Arizona. I'm joined by one of our reporters at the Sentinel, senior reporter Paul Ingram.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Who went down to the border last night to really check out the lay of the land.
So I went to the border last night, went to the Nogales and a deal. Dennis DeConcini Port of Entry, and really you just went to go do a little bit of ground truth and take a look. And what's happening right now is that we're at the end of Title 42, which was a CDC order that was put in place during the COVID-19 pandemic in March of 2020. And it was put in place really with the idea of minimizing how many people would be held in custody at Border Patrol stations, with the idea of keeping the COVID-19 pandemic from spreading in those facilities. So over time, this order has been in place. It's been in place for 3 years. But in January, the Biden administration has said, hey, the COVID-19 pandemic is over and it's time for Title 42 to end. And so that actually effectively ended on Thursday night, 9 o'clock here or midnight in Washington.
And that's because not a decision just about Title 42 ending, right? All of our sort of pandemic era COVID restrictions and a lot of the federal government activity went away with the Biden administration lifting that public health emergency that we've been under, that was first implemented by Donald Trump back in 2020.
And that's exactly right. I mean, there's all sorts of things that are attached to it. I mean, one of the things, of course, is like COVID, things like COVID testing, you know, which was free and covered, COVID vaccinations, also some federal money that were given to localities. All of that sort of stuff is wrapping up. And Title 42 is one of it. And Title 42 is kind of a shorthand for a bunch of legal structures that are in place under U.S. Code Title 42. And so when we say Title 42, we don't mean just title, all of Title 42. We mean these kind of specific
specific things that allowed authorities to basically refuse to allow anybody into the U.S. even to request asylum and other things under normal procedures.
Right. It essentially allowed Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection to remove people if they had gone through a country that had COVID-19 infections, which is pretty much everywhere.
Is there one that doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. So, but I mean, especially for people who are traveling all the way up through Mexico, who are coming up through Panama, through the Darien Gap, mm-hmm. who are coming up for, you know, from Venezuela or coming from Haiti or coming from Cuba or coming from Ukraine or the other places, they're going to travel through many countries that have COVID-19 infections. So it really means everybody.
And that has now probably ended. There was a whole flurry of legal activity last night.
Right.
So Title 42, that is gone, but there was a temporary restraining order from a federal judge in Florida that had
right.
something to do with this?
Yeah. So it's complicated. So Title 42 is dead. It's gone. It's ended.
It's still on the books, but not being used.
Well, I mean, in right. terms of being used as a border policy, it's gone. Yeah, I mean, it still exists in U.S. code, and it's something that we could bring up later. And that's ended. So at the same time, the Biden administration passed something. They put it into the Federal Register as a law, something called the transit ban. And what the transit ban does is it basically says if you've traveled through a country besides Mexico and you didn't ask for asylum, you cannot ask for asylum in the United States, at the United States-Mexico border. And so putting that in place really restricts it. Now, that doesn't affect everyone who's maybe coming up through Mexico and asking for asylum, but it affects most people who are getting it. And this is going to get really complicated here in a minute. The other thing that happened was that the Biden administration put in a policy. They sent a memo through U.S. Customs and Border Protection to try to speed up how people are being processed. And in doing that, they allowed it to parole people and using something called alternatives to detention. The idea being is that when someone comes up, they're a family, they say we're seeking asylum, they can release that person under parole. They are not accepted in the United States yet. They haven't been given asylum, but they're released from custody. The idea being is you don't want thousands of people to be held in Border Patrol custody because Border Patrol is fundamentally not built to do that. So they're releasing those people. Last night, the Florida Attorney General sued, and a judge agreed with her, and they have blocked the Biden administration from using this particular form of parole to release people.
So right now, the new policy slash regulation instituted by the Biden administration about the transit ban is still in place.
Yes.
The, that specific sort of parole for people is temporarily not being used because of this judge in Florida?
You got it. And it'll be held up for another week, and that's when there's another hearing. In the meantime, the Biden administration, of course, is going to go to the Fifth Circuit Court. They're going to ask for appeal. They may even go to the Supreme Court. So we're going to see a lot of legal fights, a lot of legal maneuvering in the next couple of days.
So we've heard from politicians from both parties, Democrats and Republicans alike, at the local level, you know, our congressional representatives, senators, all saying that the feds are not holding up their side of things in this, that the counties, cities, towns are not prepared for what might happen, the potential wave of folks. You know, you've been down to the border many times over the last 3 years and have seen people who have been basically waiting for their ability to come and request asylum to try and get into the United States, who haven't been able to because of Title 42. With it going away, are we going to see a massive influx of folks trying to come to the U.S.? What happened last night?
Well, I mean, is there a massive number of folks who are going to come to the United States? That's the million-dollar question. I don't think anyone really knows that. There are some bets about what that. DHS said that they might expect 10,000 people coming per day who would go into some part of the process under Border Patrol. The thing to keep in mind is, of course, when they say 10,000 people, that doesn't mean that 10,000 people are going to be in the country. That means that they will intercept or apprehend or encounter 10,000 people. Some of those people are going to get sent back immediately because they have a removal order already. Some of those people are going to get deported because they have criminal history. And some of those people are going to be brought in the United States because they're at the beginning part of the asylum process, which is a long, complicated process that takes now several years because of such a big backlog. At the same time, you're seeing really a large number of people who were waiting on the border, and sometimes people were waiting 6 months. I talked to people who were waiting 8, 9 months, 10 months, who were waiting for their opportunity. A lot of those people are going to be able to go through a process called CBP-1, which is this application. It's a phone application that runs and that allows people to ask for an appointment. And they get an appointment. Now, that doesn't mean that they get asylum. That just means that they get to go talk to an asylum officer and they begin the process of going through that. So one thing about the Biden administration is they really tried hard to create these kind of what they call legal pathways. And CBP is one of those legal pathways. Humanitarian parole is another legal pathway, because the Biden administration is really at the point where they're trying very, very hard to keep people from crossing irregularly, which is to say people who are crossing between the ports of entry, who cross in the desert, and even the people who are coming in crossing the desert, who are immediately show up to Border Patrol agents and turn themselves in.
But the people who are actually looking for Border Patrol agents so they can try and claim
asylum. Exactly, exactly, which is really different from other people who were, of course, dressing in camouflage, who are hiding from Border Patrol agents, who are, you know, spending 4, 5, 6, 7 days walking through the desert all to avoid Border Patrol. Those are two drastically different populations.
So last night, down in Nogales at the border crossing, set the scene.
Sure. I walked across the border line with my really cool border crossing card that I have now, and walked across, and it was basically dead. It was quiet. There was almost nobody there. There was a guy who was shilling Tosti Locos, which is a great little bag of chips with some spices and stuff. It's very tasty. And there was a small group of performers doing kind of Aztec dances. And then there were a bunch of cars. All the cars were in line, and all those cars were people who were coming to the port of entry to legally cross. And so they were waiting and kind of just hanging out until it was time for their opportunity to cross. There was no line for people who were attempting to come into the country. There wasn't a swarm of people who were asking to be let in. It was really, really quiet. The actual line to come work on the port, I walked straight through without actually seeing another person until I got to the CBP agent, and he waved me in.
So this is another kind of situation of more reporters in a place than people doing the activity we might be concerned about?
Yeah, I would really say so. I think there were several reporters there kind of looking or looky-looing and hanging out, and there were no migrants. I did see a group get deported. That group was probably one of the last Title 42 deportations. There were about two dozen people. They came off a bus. They calmly walked up through the port with a CBP official who was kind of joking with them and joshing around a little bit, and then they walked them through back across and back into Mexico. So they were going through the deportation process. I couldn't get a clear answer of exactly where there's, but I think they were actually for Title 4, under the last vestiges of Title 42.
That really kind of raises the question, and we would have to speculate, but are a lot of these concerns we're hearing about from politicians overblown? Are they seizing the moment to, stir things up?
I mean, I think that's really what it comes down to. It's a big question. I mean, how many people are actually waiting in Mexico? And the other question is, how many people want to come up through Mexico to come to the United States? And that's a really, in a way, a known number. It really depends on, of course, the economies of Venezuela. It depends on conditions in Cuba. It depends on conditions in Haiti. It depends on, how things are going in Central America. It also depends, of course, on things like Ukraine. I mean, there are people who are regularly crossing Ukraine. There's also people from Afghanistan who are still trying to get in the United States, because while we promised that we would let the people from Afghanistan in, including people who translated for the U.S. Army, that process hasn't gone very well. So there's still lots of people who may try. The Biden administration has really tried to create these legal pathways, this idea of creating a regular process so that we don't have people who are just coming up, and we definitely don't have people who are trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in the deserts.
So at least we know what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is the key of trying to figure out really who's coming and having some, situational awareness, as the phrase is, to figure out, who's really coming and whether or not there can be in the United States, and going through that legal process.
One thing that occurs to me is that, even if there is not a, immediate influx of people who have been, sort of camped out or sheltering or, somehow living along the border in Mexico, waiting to come here with the expiration of Title 42, the lifting of it, will this, encourage people who are, in Venezuela, say, to try and come here now that they might think it's easier?
Well, I think and that sort of depends on who you listen to. There are some U.S. politicians who talk about how we have open borders, and that's just literally not true. And then, of course, there are smugglers, and smuggler organizations are really good about saying, hey, I have a way to get you into the United States. You just need to pay me. It's a great way to make money. You can make a lot of money. I mean, I've heard rates as high as $20,000 to get people into the United States. So, the Biden administration is going to be in the position of having to say, no, you can't come unless you do this. And then there's other sides who are going to say, well, no, I have a special way to get you in. I haven't, a secret way. Or you also have, of course, U.S. politicians talking about how we have open borders. And so it depends on which of those messages. But the thing is, especially with like Venezuelans, there actually is now a humanitarian parole process specifically for them. Same thing with Cubans, same thing with people in Nicaragua. So they're going to go through a different process. And that process is going to look very different from somebody from like Nicaragua or from El Salvador and people from Mexico. I mean, we can't discount people, especially from southern Mexico, who are really leaving their country and they're staying in the north, because they really need to come to the United States because they're facing gangs and real threats in southern Mexico. And for them, being in northern Mexico is crazy dangerous. Mm-hmm. So that's a really different population than someone, say, who from Venezuela who, buys a ticket, flies themselves to Mexico City, and then, is able to come up and then ends up in a humanitarian parole process.
So we've been hearing a lot of numbers tossed around that seem, enormous encounters, basically, people caught or, it turned around at the border.
Right.
Leading up to this expiration, why has it been so busy? Why so much traffic, so to speak?
Well, in a lot of ways, that's a consequence of Title 42. I mean, one thing that we're sort of counting, and Border Patrol releases numbers, and they're talking about the idea of an encounter. And what that means is that a Border Patrol agent met a person and laid hands on them. The question, of course, has always been, is how many of those are the same guy? You can have occasions where you might have one person who is encountered or intercepted 6-7 times. And that's really different than the one person who shows up and asks for asylum. During Title 42, There were periods, months where 30% of the encounters were repeat people. So there's the same person being encountered again and again and again. There was one guy who was prosecuted criminally. He had entered the United States 9 times. So the question is that guy 9 encounters? Is one person? For a Border Patrol agent, that encountering the same guy 9 times matters because you're still busy. You still have to work that person. You still have to, you know, if you find them in the desert, bring them into the station. You still have to process them. You still have to figure out what to do with them next. So for them, encounters make sense. When we talk about it, people tend to consider it as a shorthand for people, and those numbers aren't the same thing. Encounters are not people.
The number of encounters, the number are of individual.
The number, yeah. The number of
and
doesn't represent
some of those
people.
Folks may have, you know, very legitimate asylum claims. They might be someone from, you know, fleeing Afghanistan, fleeing Venezuela, fleeing Cuba. That's not all, you know, quote unquote, illegal immigrants. It's people who, you know, chose a perhaps unorthodox way to try and get into the United States, you know, potentially illegally. But once you're here, you have the legal right to claim asylum, right?
Yeah. I mean, under federal law actually says it gives you the idea that you can cross, you can come to a port of entry, and you can say, I would like asylum, or you can cross at a place where there isn't one. And that was built in some ways. It makes sense. I mean, if somebody is on a boat and that boat sinks off the coast of the United States, were they accepted in the United States? Well, they didn't cross at a port. We use port not just as a place where boats park, but also
any airport, border crossing.
Any border crossing, yeah. I mean,
or an airport, yes.
Airports are ports. You know, border crossings are ports. We use that as a shorthand. So, you know, it's really about bringing that in and understanding that that's always been legal, and whether or not you come through a port or not.
And not everyone who claims asylum automatically gets asylum, right?
You got it. The process is long. It's hard. It takes time. People don't, and one thing to keep in mind is people don't get legal representation. They have to go and hire their own lawyer. So that process takes a long time.
And so the upshot of all of this would be we pretty much kind of have to wait and see how this works out over the next several weeks and months. We don't really know what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, we don't. I mean, one thing we do know is that encounters are going to go down because Title 42 isn't away. CBP is going to use something called Title 8. They're going to prosecute some people. They're going to send some people back, and they're going to put some people through the asylum process. So that's, we're going back to the old days in some ways, the of how we used to manage our borders.
So we're going to talk about this even more when we come back, but first we need to take a quick break and hear from some of the fine sponsors who make the Bill Buckmaster Show happen here on KVOI. This portion of the show is presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the famous Danish Kringle. Mona's is located at the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. They're open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch. You should treat yourself to their mouthwatering pastries, including that Kringle. Go check out monasdanishbakery.com, or you can find a link to them at buckmastershow.com. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill, and we will be right back. Thank you.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006. And the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
This The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on KVOI. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill, who's on a much-deserved anniversary trip. Joining me here in the studio is one of our reporters at the Sentinel, Paul Ingram, who does a lot of our border immigration politics coverage. And we've got a special guest, someone with some deep expertise into the border situation, Diego Pena Lopez, who works at the Casas Alitas Welcome Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you both so much for having me over here.
So we ran through a lot of the kind of political background of what's going on with Title 42, and you know, it's the COVID era policy that is being lifted because, according to the Biden administration, COVID is over. The pandemic is no longer so much of a concern, officials tell us. Can you tell us a little bit about what Casa Alitas does and how this is going to affect what your work there?
For sure. So starting off, Casa Alitas started back in 2014, really grassroots in nature with the Tucson community, receiving folks at the bus station, identifying initially that people were being dropped off oftentimes with their bags, plastic bags from Homeland Security.
And these are folks who have been
going through the asylum process.
Get picked up by DHS, CBP, Border Patrol,
whomever, processed by the feds. Ports of entry, or you know, picked up from immigration, gone through a process to make sure that they're safe to be in the country.
And then they're released with some, a kind of a quasi-legal status to await the outcome of their cases.
Yeah, go through the immigration court system for months to years.
Yeah.
And volunteers at the bus station identified them, saw a need, and reached out to Catholic Community Services to start a program. I started in 2015. As a social worker and moved up to the associate director right now. Now with the past administration and the current one, we've seen MPP, many policies restricting the volume of folks coming through to Title 42, which has been a massive restriction of many people coming through to now it being lifted as of 9 o'clock last night on our time zone. Yesterday, we saw one of the busiest days at Casa Alitas of folks coming through. Today, we've been seeing a little bit of a dip. And we're just working on navigating the folks. But Casa Alitas has been a huge group effort for the Tucson community, our staff, and other groups across the country welcoming these families.
How many folks have you assisted with the kind of this temporary respite center over the past several years?
I would say since our inception, close to 280,000 to maybe even 3,000 at this point.
That's quite a few folks.
Just a few, yeah. And it's just interesting to me, and it's fun to see with the volunteers that interaction and those stories that we share with one another to see the growth for us in welcoming the strangers to our community and knowing that any person that comes into the Alitas door, no matter what country, we're making sure to try to identify how to treat them well with the food that they're receiving and the care to get to their family members.
Can you talk a little bit about the people, where people are coming from that you've seen, especially over the last couple weeks?
Yeah, we used to see quite a few of our people coming from mostly Central America. As we've seen new policies emerge at the end of last year, we started to see quite a few people from India coming through. For me, that was a wild loop, as you can imagine. I've talked to you, Paul, about it. You know, we had many of these people from India, and a couple of weeks ago we had Ramadan, And I was noticing people praying and, you know, fasting at that point. So we were working with those guests and our volunteers to identify, you know, the changing of meals to be more culturally appropriate. So that's one small subgroup. We've been seeing people from African countries as well, and people from other places around the world.
Can you talk a little bit about how this works with CBP and with ICE? I mean, how does that come together?
Yeah. So after we built that relationship in 2014 with Teresa Cavendish, we started building a system where Border Patrol, ICE would give us a message in the morning, either through email or a phone call, and discuss these are how many people that they have to release to our shelter and how many people that they have processed that are safe to be in our Tucson community. From there, they will be dropped off to our shelter and we provide them the services. Right now, we're seeing it kind of grow and expand as policies have changed a little bit. So we're working with more diverse set of groups. So working with, for example, in Nogales, also receiving people straight from the port of entry there.
The people who are coming from the port of entry in Nogales, they're the people who are going through now the CBP One app, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit also maybe about how on Tuesday there was kind of an issue, there was about buses. There was sort of a sense that maybe people were going to be dropped off in the streets in Naco and Douglas and Nogales. And you were able to kind of make that, help that in part with the governor's office?
Oh, yeah. It's been definitely a collaboration with the governor's office, with our county, with our city, and with the different groups, the community leadership in those areas, and the volunteers too. But essentially what we were seeing is, as we have the CBP One app, folks going through that process, being able to come through at those port of entries, but not having necessarily a firm plan from DHS, what are the next steps other than those street releases? So our state and government have been able to help support those folks coming through and our other partners.
You bring up an interesting point for me. There are a lot of folks on the right wing who criticize your work, who think we shouldn't be doing this in our community, that especially that taxpayers shouldn't support it. But if you weren't, if you didn't have this center, if you weren't helping people find places to go and giving them some support and some food and shelter immediately when they're released, wouldn't these folks just be wandering around our streets, really not even knowing where they are or what to do in many cases?
We would be back to where we were in 2014, where the people would be dropped off at the bus station. At this point, the bus station is closed most of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So all these women and children and families would be just dropped off there in the Tucson heat with no services if we were not around, exactly to your point.
There. Because once the feds decide to release folks, they're releasing them, right?
Right, and it's not decide, it's a need to release them, right? It's there in the asylum process. They have a right to plead their case to the United States government that they have left their homes for fear. And oftentimes when they come to our shelter, they're quite shaken and needing us to kind of remind them that they're free, that they're able to go to the next steps to see their loved ones. And sometimes they decompensate because of all the challenges that they've had throughout their journey getting to us.
Paul, you were down at the shelter earlier this week, and a little nugget from your report on that kind of really stuck out for me, that one of the migrants that you spoke with, they didn't even really know where they were.
Yeah, it was sort of remarkable. He was walking along and he was on the phone, and he in Spanish he said, he essentially, you know, came over to two reporters and he said, "Where am I?" And we didn't actually understand the question he was asking at first. We were like, "Oh, you're at Casalitas." And he goes, No, where am I?" And we go, "Oh, you're in Tucson." He goes, "Arizona?" And I go, "Yes." And he goes, "Okay." And then he repeated that to the person that he was talking to. So he was in this midst of making travel arrangements. He has a sponsor. He is someone who is sponsoring him in the United States, and he's going to travel to that person and then go through his court appearances. This is one of the things we were talking about earlier. The thing that the Florida did is that they're limiting parole and they're limiting how the alternate detention systems work. And right now, what people are being released, they're being given a notice to appear. They have a court appearance. They have a requirement to show. And so they have to go to the next place, and they have to present themselves to the court. Mm-hmm. And then the court will start grinding through their asylum case. So they are all through in the midst of a legal process.
So, Diego, how can people pitch in? Do you need help?
Oh, we definitely always need help. We'll never say no to another helping hand, for sure. And Tucson has been a great help and generous in that manner. The ways that people can help is essentially coming, reaching out to us at Casalitas, or volunteer at casalitas.org, or look us up at casalitas.com. We are always looking at donations of clothing, underwear, socks. There's a list on our website for those sort of items. And also just staying knowledgeable. You know, this guy over here, Paul, writes a couple of articles here and there about the border, making sure that you're aware about what's going on, being able to keep up to the changes of policies and seeing that as those policies change, it definitely leads to a shift in our work and our needs from our community.
So you do get some support from the county, other government support, but you're a program of Catholic Community Services, right?
Absolutely.
So nonprofit, people can go volunteer and help out if they are of a mind to. Do you expect to need, more like hands-on volunteers with this, you know, potential influx that all these politicians are warning us about?
You know, I had a volunteer forum just 2 days ago, and we had about 190 participants of former volunteers, some people across the United States offering to say, like, how can I help remotely with Casalitas? I got those Casalitas wings, as some of us mm-hmm. like to say here. The opportunity to volunteer between our locations, there's plenty of things. I had about four new folks come in today, and we were just asking, was like, hey, remind folks to keep their masks on, you know? Remind folks to stay orderly or help serve out the food. Plenty of different tasks to do. If you speak Spanish, fantastic. We have a lot of diverse things. If you're somebody that doesn't speak Spanish but wants to help little kids get their clothing from the clothing room, that's another opportunity for help. So a lot of diverse ways to help.
How do you work with the people who are, non-Spanish speakers, you know, people from other countries who are showing up? Is that a hurdle?
It can definitely be a hurdle, but I'll tell you, yesterday evening, I think it was about 9 o'clock, I essentially got on top of, can I say table here? Would that be a problem? Radio? No, I got up in our little bird's nest, and I started reaching out to everybody saying, look, you know, we need to work as a team to take care of tomorrow's folks. And I had a staff member, because my Spanish is a little poor. I think Paul's heard me speak or try to speak Spanish a couple of times.
I mean, you get it there.
I get it there somehow. But essentially, two of the guests came back up and said, one said, like, I speak Arabic and English, so let me translate for everyone. And then somebody that spoke Punjabi came up and said it. And then you saw all those people that speak those languages coming closer and wanting and like shaking their head, asking additional questions, and started supporting cleaning the space. When we first moved into or increased our space footage in Drexel, I did essentially the same thing. I took a roll of painter's tape out, and I was starting to roll it out to make sure I had the spaces for the cots. And a guest saw it, and he raised his hand. He's like, do you need something? I'm like, yeah, can you hold this other side? And then it felt like a cartoon almost. Mm-hmm. I'm just rolling it out, putting the tape down. And I had five other rolls, and each one of them took them and started setting up those and started working on putting those cots. It's a beautiful thing to see people working globally on something, and that's what the Casalitas does. Brings our Tucson community together, our nation together, and the folks coming to the shelter.
All right. Diego Peña Lopez from Casalitas, thank you so much for giving us a glimpse into how all of these political machinations will play out here in Tucson. Really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We will be right back here on the Buckmaster Show with Andres Cano, who is the House Minority Leader. He's going to talk a little bit about our recent state budget and some other things. We will be right back.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice, broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill today. I've been joined by one of our reporters at the Sentinel, Paul Ingram, and on the live line, not quite in the hot seat, but we're going to ask him a few questions anyway, is Andres Canon, the state representative, a Democrat from Tucson, who has been the state House minority leader. Thank you very much for taking some time out of your very busy week, Andres.
Thank you for having me.
So, run down what just happened with the state budget.
Well, we have a bipartisan budget, and that is something that I committed to both Speaker Toma and to Governor Hobbs in January. We started session with a divided government, a Democratic governor, a state house, and a state senate controlled by the Republican Party by just one seat. In the House, where I've served the last 5 years, I knew early on that we would have to put our differences aside to put together a budget that is now signed into law. The governor in the last hour has signed the budget bills, and it's not perfect, but I am proud of being able to be in the room and to be able to make some true wins. $300 million going to K-12 schools, $341 million to fix the plumbing and the roofing in our public schools. There's a whole long list of things that I can talk about this budget, most important issues that are funded here. K-12, record investment in the Housing Trust Fund, $150 million. That's more than what we've ever put in to the trust fund in the last 10 years combined. So I'm proud of this budget. And like I said, it's not perfect, but it's a step in the right direction.
One of the things that makes it not perfect from the Democratic point of view would be that it doesn't really deal with the pending fiscal hole from private school tuition vouchers. There is no cap on that, and a lot of people have been comparing that to potentially the alt-fuels scandal from about 20 years ago, which really just blew a giant hole in the state budget for a while.
I think Arizonans should be concerned that the governor and the Republican leadership were not able to come to an agreement on capping these private school vouchers. We were told that this would be a $30 million program last year. It's now surpassed half a billion dollars, and the enrollment in private schools surpass now the largest school district in the state of Arizona, Mesa. There's over 54,000 students enrolled in this universal program. And so taxpayers should be concerned. This budget did include language that allows us to get some reporting requirements on where these taxpayer-funded private school vouchers are going. I think that's a step in the right direction. Certainly sympathize with some of my colleagues and the education stakeholders who recognize that it's not enough. On the House side, I was able to negotiate a study committee that is going to be going in tandem with this metrics reporting. The Senate did not agree to further analyze this ESA program. President Peterson directly to me and Democratic leaders and the governor said no. But I am glad that the architect, Mr. Toma, did say that we would be having at least five meetings over the interim before the next legislative session to see where these dollars are going. And we need a cap. We need guardrails. It makes no sense for taxpayers to be taking away so much, hundreds of millions of dollars over the next 3 years from our public schools. I think Arizonans ought to be outraged.
So that number you gave, the it was billed as a $30 million program, and now it's a $500 million program. Is that a yearly amount or over those 3 years? What are we talking about?
Right. Yeah. So it's about $1 billion over the 3 years, and so the numbers. I do believe that because there is no cap right now, right? There seems to be this idea that perhaps enrollment has been stagnant, and so it won't increase. I just have a hard time believing that, and there are deep concerns already in the system. Prior to universal empowerment scholarship accounts, we also had some special needs students who were getting these services. We're now hearing from parents who can't get a hold of the Department of Education, who are not getting the same quality of education for their students as they were a year ago. This is definitely the part of why you saw so many of my Democratic colleagues opposing this budget. It was passed in a bipartisan manner, but this is an issue that we have to address. And if we continue to ignore it, I believe that we will have to face further conversations about what our state government will have to cut. We already have a horrible regressive tax system that benefits the wealthy and the rich, and now they're enjoying even more benefits taken away from our public schools.
And is there something, once the study committee actually comes back and says, hey, we really needed a cap, is there something that can be done in the next in this fiscal year to cap that, or is this going to keep running, number going to keep running through next year?
Well, certainly we on the Democratic side will continue to offer amendments to legislation as we did this week in the budget process to cap this program. We unfortunately were not able to successfully have those amendments pass, nor was our legislation even considered this session earlier this year to make some triggers. I mean, it really is. I just have to say one thing to the listeners and to the Republican Party. Do you want our system to go bankrupt, whether it's our public schools or our state government, because of our inability to put some guardrails? I don't believe in taking things away once folks have experienced, for instance, an opportunity, an educational opportunity that perhaps they enjoy. But to not talk about any kind of cap or guardrail is not fiscally conservative. And in fact, we are every single day taking away more and more resources from those more than 1 million students in our public schools who, of course, have teachers that are underfunded, who are buying their own paper to be able to provide for our kids. I mean, the state of funding in Arizona for our K-12 schools needs to be looked at. And that's the long answer. The short answer is we need a Democratic flip at the legislature to be able to take these issues seriously. And my party is just two seats away from doing that in the state house.
So, Representative Andres Cano, you are a fairly young guy still. You've shot to the top leadership amongst state Democrats. You are the leader of the Democratic contingent in the state legislature, in the House of Representatives. And now you're going to step down? Tell us why.
I am, Dylan, and it was definitely a difficult decision. So last week I did announce to my constituents and to my colleagues that I've received a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to pursue graduate studies at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. I will be stepping down later this summer. And I made this decision in consultation with my family, and it was not an easy decision. I want Southern Arizonans to remember that prior to me serving in the legislature, I served for 7 years at Pima County working with the late Supervisor Richard Elias. I've spent 5 years now at the state legislature. So combined, that's about a dozen years of true commitment to the issues that are important to our region, to our state. And this Sunday, I'm turning 31, and I'm really excited about this next direction, and know that this is really just an extension of my commitment to public service. I was soon to be termed out in the state house, and I don't think that this should be a secret. The Kennedy School is offering to pay for the entirety of my graduate school over the next year. And I, as a first-generation college graduate, believe that more people would understand the need to say yes than the need to say no. So I appreciate the question.
So it sounds like you're not planning on being done with politics quite yet, even if you're taking a little bit of time away from it to go to school.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to dream big, and I do believe that all options are open at this point. I think my constituents have seen me grow over the last 12 years. Of course, I've stayed the same height in that process, folks, but most importantly, I think, I'm looking forward to coming back, and the legislature is certainly a place that I will miss. I'm excited to see the Democratic caucus grow in size and to finally make some progress so that we can focus on those issues that are important. Southern Arizona is my home, and I'm excited about the steps ahead.
So you told folks that you would be resigning once the state budget is done. That's now the case. And when the legislative session is ended, The budget is done much sooner than it has been over the past several years. It's been so often that things have come right down to that end of June deadline. There are some Republicans who are talking about not adjourning the legislature and keeping the session open so that they can act as they wish on the Republican side without having to have the governor call them into a special session. At what point do you say, okay, I'm good, I've got things squared away, and actually submit that letter of resignation?
It's to be determined, really. You're absolutely right. The state budget is something that is normally in late June. I was fully expecting to have this process go out until then, and we've got about 50 days left until the end of June. I'm hearing a lot of rumors right now about what's next. I mean, this coming Monday, we have potentially 80 pieces of legislation that we'll be voting on in one day. I do believe that the Republican majority is, now that they have their 31st vote restored in the state house after the expulsion of one of their members, Representative Liz Harris, I think they're probably getting ready to send all the controversial legislation that they've been waiting on over the last month to the governor, to the Senate, and to the governor. I hope she'll pay close attention to bringing us together rather than dividing us, as the Republican caucus seems to be focused on. So I'm expecting lots of vetoes in the next couple of weeks, and session may last until the end of May. It may last until the end of June. My commitment is to lead my party until the very end, and to stay focused on ensuring that we are all continuing to focus on how that legislature is going to help people. That's part of why I ran for office at the height of the Red for Ed movement, is that folks can see good things come out of that legislature under this Republican majority, under this president, this speaker. You know, I just hope that folks will recognize who has their interests in mind. We've got a recession to figure out. We've got housing crisis to appeal to and to emphasize in the next couple of weeks. And it's on the Republican Party to show us where their priorities are.
Representative Andres Cano, State House Minority Leader, thank you very much for joining us on the Buckmaster Show today.
Thanks.
We will be
right
back.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley.
Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice. I'm Dylan Smith, sitting in for Bill, who's on vacation. It's looking like it's going to be a great weekend here in the Old Pueblo, but if you really just got to get out of this place, our friends over in Silver City and Grant County are ready to welcome you with open arms. Just 3 hours east of Tucson, there's so much to do in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, where there's plenty of social distancing, and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of the many things to do and great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. If you do happen to be sitting here in Tucson, sticking around, Matt Russell has some things for you in Weekend Watch.
I sure do. Always fun listening to you at the helm when Bill's gone, Dylan. But I'm just calling this Mardi Gras in May. The crew at the Oro Valley location of Fire Truck Brewing Company, they're going to be hosting their third annual crawfish boil tomorrow, all day from 11 to 7. These babies are being flown in fresh from New Orleans. That means they're live, Dylan. And they're going to be boiled right there on site. You get a full pound of Louisiana crawfish, a potato, some corn, andouille sausage, some dirty rice. And, of course, it's a brewery, so you're going to have some great suds to wash down all those mud bugs. So get your tickets now. Eventbrite.com has them. Just search for the Fire Truck Crawfish Boil.
Right on. What else you got?
You know, I dote on my mom every chance I get, but the doting will be in double time this Sunday, as we all love on our moms this Mother's Day. Of course, for me, food should always be at the center of the affair. So lots of options to choose from. Hacienda del Sol has a great Mother's Day buffet. A Gallery of Food has got a brunch box that you can order that'll be delivered right to your door, along with, you know, entrees and sides and a greeting card and fresh flowers, fresh squeezed OJ, and more. You can go to TucsonFoodie.com to get the full drill down on all the great Mother's Day options around town.
Thank you so much for keeping us up to date on what to do around here, Matt Russell.
My pleasure, brother. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening here on the Buckmaster Show on 1030 The Voice. Sitting in for Bill, I've been Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel. I've been joined by Paul Ingram, our senior reporter at the Sentinel.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our guests, State House Minority Leader Andres Cano and Diego Peña Lopez of Casa Salidas. I got to tell everybody, the Buckmaster Show is produced by Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, which is solely, wholly, totally responsible for its content. On behalf of all of us here and Bill's longtime executive assistant, Rosemary Brandt, and the entire team at Bustos Media Tucson, including engineer Tom Fairbanks, have a wonderful and safe weekend. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there.